This is Examining Education, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. Today's program looks at vouchers and their role in school reform. While the Obama administration is ending the voucher program in Washington, D.C., John Kasich, governor of Ohio, just doubled the number of vouchers available in his state. Meanwhile, Mitch Daniels, governor of Indiana, has just made Indiana the second state in the country to institute a statewide voucher program. On this program, we'll be talking to three guests. We'll find out about the history of vouchers in this country. We'll also hear what some feel are the strengths of the program. And we'll hear about underlying reservations about the program. First, to get some history on vouchers and some general context, is Cecilia Rouse, professor in the economics of education at Princeton. Welcome to the program, Professor Rouse.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with you telling us about your involvement with the issue of vouchers.
Well, I started to get interested in vouchers when I was a graduate student in economics in the late 1980s, early 90s. We were reeling from the publication of A Nation at Risk, which was a publication which argued that educational attainment in the United States was very low and that our schools were underperforming, and many people were interested in finding ways to reform our system. It was on the heels of the publication of a provocative book by John Chubb and Terry Moe, which is called Politics, Markets, and America's Schools, which argued that really it was the structure of the public schools that led to their underperformance and that a voucher system might help. But that caught my attention. I got more involved as a researcher later that decade, in the late 90s, when some data became available from Milwaukee, which allowed me to study the impact of Milwaukee's parental choice program on student outcomes. And so I started there, and I have stayed interested in the topic and have written many papers reviewing the various pieces of evidence.
Well, let's begin by if you could define for us what a voucher is.
So as many of your listeners know, schools in the United States, public schools in the United States, are funded from local property taxes and state income taxes, state sales taxes, but state revenues. And so anybody who lives in a district can go to the local public schools, ostensibly free of charge, but obviously they have paid through the property taxes, or if they're renting, through the increase in rent that goes for property taxes, et cetera. If you go to a private school, you have to pay those property taxes to be supporting the public schools, and you have to pay the private school tuition. So what vouchers do is they provide, in a sense, it's a grant or a scholarship that is a portion of the money that would ordinarily go to the public schools. The parent can use that portion of money to help offset or completely pay for the tuition in the private school. So they're really a form of a publicly funded scholarship or a publicly funded grant to attend a private school.
What percentage are they usually of what's actually spent, say, in a public school?
This can vary depending on the program. Sometimes it's about half of what they might have allocated towards the public school. I don't think I've seen it where it's the entire allocation that would go to the public school. But it can be half, three-quarters of what would typically be given to the local public school.
Well, you've talked a little bit about how it began. So what is their history in this country?
So towns in New Hampshire and Vermont have actually used school vouchers for possibly up to a century because in many towns, the towns are so small, they just don't have enough students to support a public school system. So, you know, in some sense, these are very old and traditional in the United States where they've really been necessary because it was not cost efficient for a town to provide themselves. So instead, the town gives the money to the parent and they can choose to send their child to another school. But the recent history, I would date, maybe it's because I'm an economist, I would date to the early 1960s when Milton Friedman of the University of Chicago argued for using school vouchers as a way of bringing more competition to the educational marketplace, if you will. Right now in the United States, once a parent chooses to live in an area, once they buy their house or rent an apartment, their child is assigned to the local public school, which in a sense gives the school a monopoly on that child in terms of their schooling. Friedman argued that monopolies are not very cost efficient, that they provide lower quality for too high of a price, and that if instead, once a parent had chosen where to live, they could choose from a wider range of schooling options that would force the schools to compete for that parent's dollars and therefore bring innovation to our educational system. So that was Milton Friedman in the early 60s. Interestingly, in the United States, more practically speaking, it was actually individuals on the left, I would say, who first picked up the idea of school vouchers. There was an experiment in a school district in California called Alum Rock, which tried them in the early 1970s as a way to provide alternative schooling for low-income students. So their interest was not necessarily in trying to bring in competition, but to give more options for students. More recently, then, we had Chubb and Moe, who in the late 1980s, from the other side of the political spectrum, arguing for school vouchers as a way to bring in competition. They were going back to the Milton Friedman argument. At the same time, in Milwaukee, Milwaukee put into place the first large-scale publicly funded voucher system. It was largely fueled by Howard Fuller, a former superintendent of the Milwaukee Public Schools, and his interest was in providing alternative options for students that he thought were basically trapped in what were low-performing schools. Since then, there have been various attempts. There are some small programs. Washington, D.C. has a small opportunity scholarship program. Cleveland has a scholarship program, and actually the state of Ohio has a statewide, what they call, Ed Choice program. Indiana has a statewide program. Florida had a program that was attached to its accountability system until their state declared it unconstitutional. And so you've seen various attempts around the country, usually at the city level, you know, occasionally at Ohio at the state level, to bring this kind of choice to the school system.
Well, now going back to Alum Rock, how did that work out?
In Alum Rock, interestingly, it didn't work out very well. They never really were able to implement a true voucher program. What it evolved to was more of an open enrollment program. Open enrollment is a form of school choice, and that says that you've chosen where you're going to live, but you don't necessarily have to attend the local public school that's in what we call the attendance area. Instead, parents can choose from any school within the school district. So Alum Rock, in some ways, the intent was to put in a voucher system, but the implementation never really achieved vouchers.
So has there been much variation in their implementation in the different places that you've mentioned?
Yes. So since Alum Rock, the voucher programs have been implemented as voucher programs. In Milwaukee, it started small. It started with, I think, only about 11,000 students being potentially eligible to use the vouchers. They're targeted towards low-income students. And initially, it was limited to only non-sectarian private schools. Today, they have a cap of 22,000 students that can participate. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court declared that they could apply to sectarian schools as well. And so in Milwaukee, the students really do have a choice of private schools. Similarly in Cleveland and Ohio and Washington, D.C.
You were saying, for example, Milton Friedman was saying it would be less expensive. I think at one point somebody had mentioned that he thought it would bring the cost of schooling down to 50% or something. Has it been less expensive, and what have been the results?
That I would argue that that is one of the outcomes of vouchers that we don't fully understand. I have never seen a study, and I'm not saying one hasn't been done, but I'm unaware of any studies that have looked at, say, the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program to really study its impact on the cost of providing schooling. On its face, the way that, say, Milwaukee is structured is the schools have to take the voucher as the full tuition. And so most schools are not going to be offering tuition that's less than the voucher. So it's hard to see whether the schools are really providing a comparable education for less money than what they may get in the public schools. When I was studying this, I was trying to get a better understanding of how much does it actually cost to educate a child in a private school. And I found it pretty difficult to get that information from the private schools, but the schools that I did call said to me that the tuition is not the full cost of educating a child in their school, but that they use other sources of funding to subsidize that cost of providing the education. So I think it's pretty difficult. On its face, it looks as though it's less expensive to educate a child in a private school, but I'm not sure we fully understand all the sources of revenue and all the sources of the cost pressure in the all the sources of revenue in the private sector and all of the cost pressures in the public sector, so that we can compare it apples to apples.
Well, what about achievement? Has achievement improved?
So I like to think of vouchers as potentially affecting achievement in two ways. First, you give a voucher to a child. That child can use that voucher to attend any school. According to Milton Friedman's way of thinking and the way most of us economists think, if the parent, and this is a big if the parent is only choosing a school based on what the parent thinks it will do for their child's academic achievement, then you would expect when the child uses a voucher to go to a private school, that child's achievement will increase. I say that's a big if because I think parents look at a broader range of characteristics of schools, like safety and convenience even, when choosing a school. But if they're really focused just on the academics, we would really expect to see the academics increase. I consider that the direct effect. In terms of publicly funded programs, I would argue that the evidence has been actually fairly mixed as to their impacts. In Milwaukee, I found that there were gains for those students in math achievement, but not in reading. The results in Cleveland have been even smaller than what I found in Milwaukee, and even more mixed, and sometimes finding even negative impacts. If you look at the DC voucher program, there were no impacts after 2 years. After 3 years, they're finding a little bit of an increase in reading and not seeing much in math. And if you look at Florida, what we did see was that the Florida system was that students who were attending schools that were rated F out of their accountability system, schools are graded A through F, so failing schools, if a school was failing for 2 years, 2 out of 3 years, the students could use the voucher to attend a private school or a higher rated public school. What we saw is that the schools that in which the students were eligible for vouchers saw big improvements in their test scores. Now, is that because the students actually used the vouchers, or is it because the threat of the students using the voucher made the school improve, or is it because just the stigma of receiving an F generated a knot of activity among the school administrators? Voucher proponents would argue it was because of the voucher threat. David Figlio is at Northwestern University, and I have some evidence to suggest it might actually have been due to the stigma. I would argue that we really don't know since they were bundled, but it's not obvious that that was a voucher due to the threat of vouchers. So overall, I'd say it's fairly mixed in terms of short-run achievement.
Uh-huh. So what groups or people do you see as most supportive of vouchers?
I think that they come, just to be very black and white, come in two flavors. I think there are those who support vouchers because they view them as an alternative for students who otherwise are assigned to attend failing schools. So they see it as a way to help those students have additional choices because the voucher does obviously help pay the tuition for those who wish who are dissatisfied with their local public school. And then there are those who I would argue that are more in the Milton Friedman style, which is view this as a bigger reform, that they view it as not only should we have vouchers because we want to help the achievement of that one student who uses a voucher, but because they believe that the increased competition will generate reform for the whole system as a whole. You may see more of those individuals who are trying to generate more competition as being on the right, and those who are trying to help low-income students more on the left. But I think that those are the two broad groups of people who are supportive.
What about opposition to vouchers?
So opposition, I think, comes largely from those who believe that most students need to be educated within the public sector. There are those who worry that by diverting funds that would ordinarily go to the public schools to these vouchers, which then go to private schools, that will slowly erode the integrity and the strength of our public schools and make it even that much harder for them to improve. I think that's largely the basis for opponents. Then there are some who are, I wouldn't call them opponents, but they're not fervent supporters, who look at the evidence and say, you know, it's not like this is going to be the panacea for improving our educational system. You know, they may not be opposed to vouchers, but they're not looking to vouchers to be the major education reform to save the day.
So what do you see as the future of vouchers in our country?
Well, I think that I'm not entirely sure exactly about the future. I think that there will always be those people who believe that we should be offering another choice for students, especially, you know, at one point we may all be very happy with our public schools, but until then it will always feel unequal that individuals who are wealthy can afford to send their child to private school, whereas those who had the unlucky draw of not having a high income can't afford to do so. And so it wouldn't surprise me if we continue to see smaller scale voucher programs, which are implemented within certain school districts or within some states in a limited way. Legislatures have not been as successful at passing voucher programs, and furthermore, a lot of states have constitutional requirements or limitations on the ability to allow private schools to participate in a voucher program if they were to have one. And so it's until some of those are resolved, it seems to me that there's going to be kind of there's going to be limits as to how big vouchers can become in the United States.
We've been speaking with Cecilia Rouse, professor in the economics of education at Princeton. Our topic today is school vouchers. In a moment, we talk to Harvard professor Paul Peterson. He is a supporter of vouchers and feels school choice leads to children learning more and forces schools to compete to be better. I'm Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley, and this is Examining Education. You're listening to Examining Education. Today we're looking at vouchers and their role in school reform. My next guest is Paul Peterson, the Henry Lee Shattuck Professor of Government and Director of the Program on Education Policy and Governance at Harvard. He's the author of Saving Schools from Horace Mann to Virtual Learning. Let's begin, Professor Peterson, by telling us a little about yourself and your involvement with research about vouchers.
Well, I've been studying schools and the American educational scene since I was an assistant professor back at the University of Chicago, and actually taught at the University of Illinois one term many years ago, as far back as 1970. And I took a look at the Chicago public schools back then, wrote a book about them, and discovered that there were many, many problems with our big city school system. Of course, in those days, they were going through desegregation, and they were trying to find a way to provide for more community control, and the collective bargaining process was just beginning. And then I moved away from education and studied urban problems more generally after that. But I came back to the field of education in the 1990s, but with a new sort of perspective, one that said, really, the existing institutional structure hasn't changed for all these many years. It's really time to think about what kinds of new structures will provide better educational opportunities for young people.
And so then you worked with vouchers?
Well, it was sort of an accident that Milwaukee public school system began a school voucher program, and there was some research that was being done on that school system, and I happened to take a look at the data that had been collected using the randomized field trial that was hidden in the data. And when randomized field trials is what's used in medical research, where you give some people a pill and other people a placebo, and then you find out whether or not the pill works by comparing the two groups of people. And we were able to do that in Milwaukee, and we found out that the voucher program seemed to have beneficial effects after 3 to 4 years. So that was a big impact study that, surprisingly, because the news media paid a lot of attention to it. And as a result, I was able to undertake some additional studies like that in other places in Washington, D.C., and New York City, and Dayton, Ohio. And we found beneficial effects in these other places as well, especially for African American students. And then I've been sort of following the story ever since.
So what would you say the arguments in favor of vouchers are?
Well, let me give you one example. Around the world, virtually every country finances both its public schools and its private schools. They do that in the United Kingdom. They do that in France. They do that in the Netherlands. They do that in Sweden. They do that in Australia. They do it in Canada. They do it in New Zealand. They do it in Germany. They do it in Spain. And they do it in Italy. So every country, and many, many other places, every country supports both its public and private schools, and then lets the families decide where the children that they have should go. And the countries where there's a bigger private sector, the kids learn more. Not just in the private schools, but also in the public schools. So it's not like the private schools are better than the public schools in these countries. It's the countries where there's a lot of choice, the kids are learning more at the age of 15. That's when we have test score data available in math, reading, and science. And across all subjects, the kids who are live in countries where there's a lot of choice and the government supports them on both sides, those kids are learning more. So that's the biggest benefit.
Well, so that's basically it? The major argument is that it increases learning?
Well, fundamentally, that's what you're most concerned about, because that's what schools are for. Purpose of education is to educate. And so if kids aren't learning more, then you want to say, okay, well, we better think about what to do about that situation, right? So, yeah, if competition between your public and your private schools was not leading to better schools, then you certainly wouldn't want to have that kind of a program. But we know this from all other fields of activity, that where there's competition, there tends to be a better quality product. The problem of the old Soviet Union was there was no competition, and people had to take the car or the auto or the refrigerator or whatever that the government gave them. So the quality of what was being given wasn't very good. So, and we learned that from the automobile industry in the United States, that once we got competition from the Japanese automobile makers, we got a lot better cars, not only from Asia, but also from within the United States. So, competition is something that we find in almost every sector of our society is a beneficial thing.
So what about the current, I know there was a current study of the Milwaukee schools that had a panel was equally divided between supporters and advocates and critics, and I thought that they came out saying that there wasn't any difference.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that the public schools in Milwaukee have improved in recent years since the voucher program went to a sizable scale. And generally speaking, one should not expect to see a large difference between public and private schools if you have a competitive system. So that's the same thing could be said about the schools in Germany. There's a lot of private schools and there's a lot of public schools. It's not the case that the private schools are better than the public schools, but what is the case is that all the schools are better than they otherwise would have been in the absence of the competition between them. So we don't really have anywhere in the United States a scaled-up system that's been around for a long period of time. It really takes decades to really see how this is going to work over the long period of time. So that's why the international experience is so informative.
Well, what about the current demonstrations in Chile, which are against vouchers?
Well, the Chilean educational system has improved enormously in recent years, and the competition between the public and the private sector has been very beneficial. And the problem with a lot of the studies of Chile is that they compare the public to the private sector when you really want to see how is Chile doing relative to other countries. And certainly Chileans have improved. The situation of the people of that country has improved in many respects, and one of them has been in the quality of their schools.
Well, how would you describe the supporters of vouchers? What groups do you see, or is it a particular political perspective that are people who support vouchers as opposed to the opponents?
Well, actually, every year the journal that I am responsible for, Education Next, does a survey of the American public, a representative sample of the American public. So this is just like a Gallup poll. It's the same kind of thing. We have done this now for 5 years. And the interesting thing about support for vouchers is that it was steadily declining until last year, and now it's gone back up again. So there's been a reversal in terms of public support. When you look at Democrats and Republicans, you find actually there's more support from Democrats than there is from Republicans. And that's probably due in good part because there's so much support for vouchers among African Americans and Hispanics, but even more so from African Americans and Hispanics. And the reason, and that's really consistent with my original findings, that I found bigger positive effects from having the opportunity to go to a private school for African Americans than anybody else. It's hard to know exactly what the reason is, but I suspect it's because they're going to the poorest public schools.
Well, are we conflating vouchers and charter schools, or are you keeping them separate?
Well, they're both giving students choice. The biggest difference between them is that vouchers give students the opportunity to go to a faith-based school, whereas charter schools are schools that are privately managed but receive government support, but they cannot offer religious instruction, and they must admit students by means of a lottery. So, yes, you could, and they're subject to more government regulation than private schools are. So there's similarities, but there's differences, and I'd say the most important difference is whether or not the school provides faith-based education. Now, some people don't think you should have government support for schools that are faith-based. Countries all over the world do have that. I think our private schools that are faith-based, our Lutheran schools, our Catholic schools, our Episcopalian schools, our Jewish schools, many of them have a long and deep tradition. And that's a very valuable educational resource because it's not easy to build a good school. Our charter schools, some of them are truly excellent schools. The KIPP schools are a good example of that, but there are others as well. Others are not that good, and they all suffer from the fact that they're fairly recent institutions. None of them have a history of more than 20 years. Many of them have a history of less than 10. And it's not like the charter school idea isn't worth considering, but it's trying to create good schools overnight, and I think the real advantage of vouchers, it takes advantage of good schools that have been around for a long period of time.
Well, what about arguments that choice winds up in segregating society, so that the rich children go with rich, or particular religions just go to school with each other?
Well, it's a matter of whether you think it's a bad thing for students to go to school with children of the same religion or not. As a matter of fact, there's so much admission of students from other religious backgrounds to schools that do have a religious orientation that, yes, probably there are more Catholics at a Catholic school than there are Protestants, but you're always going to find a substantial Protestant presence, and same would be true of a Lutheran school. So I don't think these are as... we're not living in the 19th century, we're living in the 21st century, so there's a lot more mixture there. And secondly, I think the fact of the income distinction is not as people tend to think of it. There's only a very small percentage of our schools that are exclusive schools serving the very wealthy. Most private schools are either Christian schools or Catholic schools that serve people of very moderate income.
So you're not worrying that this would stratify children too much, or our population?
Well, the greatest stratification that we have is by neighborhood in the United States. So we have extreme stratification in our public school system. There is no system as stratified as our public school system. The suburban schools are oftentimes lily white. The most exclusive suburbs are attended by children of very well-to-do people. Our inner-city schools serve almost entirely a minority population. It's a very poor population on top of that. So I would say the stratification is at least as large, probably a good deal larger in the public sector than the private sector.
What do you see as the future of vouchers in the United States?
Well, I would have said a year ago or 2 years ago that they're probably something that was tried that's not going to expand, but in the past year there certainly has been a change in that regard. Indiana, just across the road from Illinois, is launching a substantial expansion, moving in this direction. It never had vouchers before. The state of Wisconsin is expanding its voucher program. Ohio is expanding its voucher program. So particularly in the Midwest, there's been a great deal. New Jersey is exploring the idea. So this is on the agenda. And the tax credits, which are a close neighbor of vouchers, are also being tried out in Arizona and Florida and several other states. So I'd say the worm has turned in the last 12 months.
How would you explain that?
Well, certainly the election of 2010, there were a lot of Republicans who ran for office were supportive. It's one of the greatest ironies of the debate over vouchers is that even though the support for vouchers is greater among Democrats at the grassroots level in terms of the political leadership, it's supported more by Republicans, and that's primarily because of the close association between the teachers' union and the Democratic Party.
We've been talking to Paul Peterson, the Henry Lee Shattuck Professor of Government and Director of the Program on Education Policy and Governance at Harvard. Coming up next, we hear about the reservations some critics of vouchers have about the program. This is Examining Education. This is Examining Education. I'm your host and producer, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. Today we're looking at vouchers and their role in school reform. My guest is Martin Cornoy, professor of education at Stanford. He's a labor economist with a particular interest in the political economy of the educational system. Well, let's begin, Professor Cornoy, by telling us a little about yourself and your involvement with research about vouchers.
My involvement started since I'm interested in international education, as well as what's going on in the U.S., since there was a national voucher plan in Chile, which had been going on since 1981. I went with one of my students, Patrick McEwen, to Chile in 1997. And although there had been some stuff written about it, there it was not very well known in the United States. It was not very well done. So he and I began writing about the Chilean voucher plan and published several papers on that. And that involved everybody in Chile. They were available to everyone and had been going on for a long time. So we had really a lot of information about that. So that's how I started. And then I looked at the voucher plan in Sweden, which had also started in the 1990s, and compared that. And I also wrote a book about the Milwaukee voucher plan a few years ago, looking at data up to the mid of the decade to 2005. And I've really written a lot of stuff about vouchers and about charters. When you look at these things from a research standpoint, what you're really trying to examine is two things. First of all, examining the claim that private education actually is more effective than public education, which is one of the claims being made. And the second thing is, the other claim that's being made, is that the competition between private schools where the playing field is leveled, in other words, one gets a voucher which is may not be equal to the total cost of the schooling, but it does provide a very large scholarship to people, and therefore the competition for those private schools actually improves public schooling. Those are the two main claims. And so in the Chilean case, we examined both the effectiveness argument, we examined the cost-effectiveness argument, and we also examined the competition argument. Milwaukee, I focused much more on the competition argument because it, until very recently, when John Witte and Patrick Wolf got a big grant to look at, to compare private students in private schools and public schools in Milwaukee. Since the Wisconsin legislature basically gave private schools a pass on taking the Wisconsin state test, it was impossible to tell whether the private schools were doing better than the public schools.
So what did you find? What were your observations?
Well, we were the first to show in Chile that if you control for the social class of the children attending the schools, that there was really no difference in effectiveness between the private and public schools. So that argument we showed was there are two kinds of private schools in Chile. There are those which are subsidized through the vouchers, in other words, and the growth of those has been enormous. Even in the last 10 years, they've grown even more. People prefer private schooling, privately managed schooling in Chile because they associate that with what the middle class had attended in the past. Even in 1981, 20% of kids went to basically Catholic schools or private independent schools. And so that was seen as, if you could go to a private school, that's what you should do if you could afford a private school. So when they gave vouchers, everybody started, who could, find a privately managed schools, slowly began to go to those schools. So there's been a big shift to that kind of schooling. In Milwaukee, I think there were a lot of studies done, some of which claimed that the private schools were, in the original experiment, were somewhat more effective for kids that stayed in for 4 years in the schools. Then when the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 1997 or 98, I think it was 98, maybe it was 97, said that religious schools could receive subsidies from the state, could receive vouchers, then everything changed. And by now, I think they're probably around 20% of kids in Milwaukee go to voucher schools, go to private schools with vouchers. A bunch of others, kids go to charter schools, which started later. And in addition to that, there's complete public school choice. So parents can choose any school in the city to send their kids to. Of course, neighborhood kids get priority, but people move their kids to other public schools. According to Deb Lindsay, who's the research director of the Milwaukee Public School System, only 25% of kids attend their neighborhood school in Milwaukee.
Ah.
So it is a total choice program. In Santiago, about 65% of kids attend private schools, maybe even more, 70% by now, attend privately managed or private independent schools.
But then I know that recently there were demonstrations in Chile, student demonstrations against vouchers.
Yes, that, and I'm in contact with them. They want me to say things about the vouchers. The argument is really, they're arguing against for-profit schools. Basically, there are many for-profit schools in Chile that get vouchers, get subsidized. But there's a real question of, I understand their argument against vouchers, but the real problem in Chile, the vouchers have caused a tremendous stratification of kids in schools. Because the public schools are essentially now all very poor kids, and they're concentrated in those schools, your likelihood, there are very good data in Chile on how kids are concentrated in schools. If you're in the bottom 10% of the income groups in Chile, the bottom 10%, you have a 90% likelihood of being with kids from the bottom 20% of income in your school. If you're in the top 10% of income, you have over 90% probability of only being with kids from the top 10% of income.
Wouldn't the same thing happen in the United States?
I believe so. They made it even worse in Chile, strangely enough. The government that came in after the military in 1994 allowed... officially allowed schools to charge fees and receive vouchers. They lost part of the voucher if they took fees, but they only lost for every dollar that they received in fees, for every peso that they received in fees, they only lost, 20% of their voucher, 20 cents of their voucher. So it was a very good deal to take fees.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the big division occurred between schools that accepted fees and schools that did not accept fees. So there's very little social class difference in Chile between voucher schools that don't take fees and public schools. And
well,
there's a very big difference between schools that accept fees and, by the way, also are allowed to select their kids. It's not lottery. They're allowed to select their kids by examination and interview, et cetera. So there's a big division now, but even within voucher schools.
What do you see as the underlying motives for those who are supporting vouchers in our country?
You know, it's, given the fact that the data, but I want to bring you up to date on Milwaukee, because my book argued that there was no competition effect. So, Carolyn Hoxby, economist that's now at Stanford, used to be at Harvard, was very pro-vouchers, showed that in the first 2 years after the voucher plan was the new voucher plan in 98, so 98 and 99, and 98, 99, and 99, 2000, she said that there was a big effect of vouchers on public schools.
Mm-hmm.
Public schools improved significantly. And in fact, I reran her data, and in fact, in those first 2 years, there was an effect.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is why there was an effect, because after that, there's been no effect. And the main move to vouchers was after 99, 2000. Because in the first 2 years, the main group that took advantage of vouchers were kids who were already in private schools. Because there were kids in private schools already, in Catholic schools mainly, in religious schools, who fell under the... It's a targeted voucher program, so now they've lifted the level, but it used to be 175% of the 1.75 times the poverty line. So if you're under that, you could get a voucher. Well, a lot of kids were already in private school who were under 1.75 of the poverty line. They were subsidized by the church, et cetera. So the church, instead of subsidizing, they took the voucher for kids that were already in there. So that was the big move. So that shouldn't have had any effect on public schools, because there's hardly any movement out of the public schools. So she showed that there was this big effect, and I wrote that I thought there was a kind of a scare effect of the vouchers on the public schools, and they started teaching to the test,
mm-hmm.
and got a bump. They got a bump. After that, there was no bump.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Witte and Wolf have shown, it's now the third year that they have done this, there is no difference in the test scores between the private and public schools. The voucher schools don't do any better than the public schools.
I was wondering about, for example, Libertarian, their argument, not so much that it's the effect or the competition, but that it will get government out of the business of schools.
Well, that's completely untrue, because the government pays for the schools. See, what's interesting is that John Stuart Mill, who is sort of before Hayek, the sort of the godfather of all this, argued for private schools only. He didn't want government in schooling, and so that's consistent. So he only wanted private schools, and people would have to pay for them. But he wanted people to be required to send their kids to school, and it would be the government who would enforce that. That's number one. Number two, Milton Friedman comes along and says, well, you know, you can't do that because a lot of people can't afford to go, so you're not going to break the public school monopoly if you don't give some kind of subsidy to people and level the playing field between public schools and private schools. So that's when he argued for the vouchers. So you're not getting government out. What you're doing is saying that by having, his argument was that if you have the competition, then you break the public school monopoly. But his main argument, I have to tell you, was for Friedman, the fact that there was a monopoly meant that public schools cost a lot more than they should cost. That there was a kind of a monopoly power, and that implicitly it was teachers and administrators who are getting too high salaries because they had a monopoly power over the schools. And he was at Stanford he was my professor at Chicago, but then I've debated him at Stanford and had long discussions with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he backed two voucher proposals in California in 1993 and I believe 2001. And in both of those, he argued that the value of the voucher should be half the amount of the cost per student in public schools, because he believed that, in fact, you could deliver schooling for half the price.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that was because you would break the monopoly and you would lower the price. That the main effect was to lower the price. He never argued for better test scores coming out of private schools. He never made that argument. He basically made two arguments, and I thought that's what you were going to say, was the libertarians believe not only to get the government out of schooling, but they believe that by choice, when you have choice, you actually are better off. And when you hear the voucher people argue, they'll say, look, parents are happier because they have a choice. In Chile, people like vouchers because it gives them a choice. So I think that argument is a good one. There have been studies, D.C. Charter schools, that show that after a few years, the parents in the charter schools complain just as much as the ones in the public schools.
Well, let me ask the last question. What do you see as the future of vouchers in the United States?
I think it's dead.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's dead. I think this Washington voucher plan is sort of the last. I mean, it didn't really work. I mean, Patrick Wolf argued that you got some effect after 3 years, but in fact, it was a minor effect. It didn't affect the poorest kids, the ones it was supposed to affect. It's the Republicans revived it in D.C. I mean, it was one of Boehner's pet projects, but they did it. But I think it's dead. I mean, they're not starting anywhere. He was even defeated in Utah, of all places, because there are other forms of people trying to subsidize private education. For example, in Florida, they have the state is not allowed to give vouchers to religious schools. So what the state does is form the foundation, and corporations can donate to the foundation and get not a tax write-off against income, but actually a tax credit. So every dollar they donate, they can deduct a dollar from taxes. And then that foundation, which is basically run by the state, gives money to private schools, that gives vouchers to kids in low-scoring public schools so that they can go to private school. So there are all kinds of ways around it, and there's tremendous, of course, people want charters. The group that supports vouchers has switched heavily into the charter movement. But vouchers, statewide vouchers, are very unpopular because the middle class is basically happy with their public schools, and they do not want to subsidize people who already have their kids in private schools.
We've been talking to Professor Martin Carnoy of Stanford University. Our topic today was school vouchers and what role they play in school reform. Next time, we'll be discussing standardized testing. We have a website, examineducation.org, where you can listen to past programs, find out more about our speakers, follow links to other websites with more details about issues raised in our discussions, and where you can send us your suggestions and comments. You can also find us on Facebook, Examining Education. Our managing editor is Jason Croft. We had audio support from Mike Pritchard. I'm your host and producer, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley.